13CA 1407, French et al. Versus Evans. And I want to make sure that I have these names right. I know the appellant is Lynn French, and then Mr. and Mrs. Norrie?
Norrie.
Norrie, is that correct?
Norrie.
Okay, thank you. And then we have the Evans as appellees, cross appellants. So in that regard, with regard to the fact that we have two appeals here, or cross appeals, there's a little bit of logistics we need to talk about first. We have extended oral arguments to 25 minutes per side. I know we have two parties on the appellant's side over here, and one party on the appellee's side. So I need to know, we need to know from appellants how you want to divide your time between Mr. French and Mr. and Ms. Norrie's arguments, and how much time you might want for your primary argument in their behalf, and how much time you want to reserve, and how you're going to split that for your answer and rebuttal to the cross appeal. So if you can let us know that, that would be very helpful.
Your Honor, Earl Rhodes on behalf of Lynn French, Mr. Stippert on behalf of the Norries, and we have an agreement that Mr. Stippert will go first for 10 minutes, I will go second for 5 minutes, and Mr. Stippert's going to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, let me get this right again. Repeat that for me. Mr. Stippert is going to go first.
Correct, for 10 minutes.
10 minutes.
I'm going to go second for 5 minutes. And Mr. Stippert's going to reserve rebuttal for 10 minutes.
Rebuttal for 10 minutes. And you realize that within that rebut for 10 minutes is going to be, let's see, your time to rebut and answer. Because Ms. Ebisch?
Ebisch.
You're going to answer their appeal, and then you're going to argue your appeal. And then in the latter part of your argument, you're going to answer and rebut within that same 10 minutes.
Yeah, not a lot of time all the way around. But I think these issues are intertwined enough that that would be okay.
Okay. All right. Just so we have so we know what we're doing here.
And I plan to reserve time.
Right, and you're
also.
And you're going to reserve time so that you can rebut, or actually it would be reply. Or no, rebut, you're right. Okay, so you're going to reserve 5 minutes for that.
Yes.
Okay. So, you can be seated. Yeah. Well, we talked about doing here, Bayless, so that we can, we want to make sure that that Mr. Stempert and Mr. French, I'm not French.
Rhodes.
Rhodes, I'm sorry. Mr. Rhodes represents Mr. French, right? That neither one of you, takes up one of the other's time, because we know that you have potentially different arguments. So we're going to go, first of all, Bailiff, with 15 minutes for the first part of your argument, and I'll keep track of the 10 and 15, or 10 and 5 within that, all right? And then for Ms. Ebisch's argument, we'll just go to 25, showing the last 5 as it normally shows on the clock. Okay? Any additions to that, judges? All right. And if anybody has come in since we were in recess, I want to remind you to please turn off any cell phones or pagers or anything else that you might have that would go off and interrupt the arguments. Any other questions, counsel, about our policies and procedures? essentially the time is self-monitoring, but because of this situation, I'm going to try to let you know when, Mr. Stempert, when your 10 minutes is getting close. And same with Mr. Rhodes.
Your Honor, will the, I see a timer up there, will I be able to look at that?
Yes.
All right.
When you get up there and get started, the timer will show, it should show 15 minutes. And so you can time it down to five. There's a button on the podium that raises or lowers it to adjust to your height. Unless there are any other questions, I think we are ready to proceed. Court calls the case of French versus Evans, 13 CA 1407.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Over the last 8 years of litigation that this case has been going on, we have some rather remarkable circumstances that have come up that have led us to here today. It started off with the Evanses and their 600-acre ranch, and they were in dire straits. That's what the district court held. Financially, they needed $200,000 to pay off a loan. They were had foreclosure threatening them, and they had a lot of personal debts for medical bills from Ms. Evans. So they devised a plan. They were going to sell 200 acres of their 600-acre ranch. And Mr. Glenn Clark, who is also a party to this case, had been living on this 200-acre portion of the upper ranch for, I think, over 20 years. He was good friends with Mr. Evans. But he didn't have the money to buy it. So he came to my clients, the Norries, and said, hey, do you have the money to buy this land? They're asking $200,000 for it. Actually, they asked $150,000 initially and then asked for $50,000 more. And my client said, okay, well, I've seen the land, I've invested in property in the area. My clients were good friends with Mr. Clark as well. And they said, okay, we'll do that. As such, they wired $200,000, sight unseen, to the Evanses before anything was signed on April 4th, 2001. That got the Evanses out of trouble financially. The next day, the Evanses and Clarks signed this agreement that has been the source of so much contention, this option, whatever you want to call it, this one-page contract, and also signed a deed of trust and promissory note in favor of the Norries. My clients didn't know about this. They didn't know that this was going on behind the scenes. They were just trusting Glenn Clark that the deal was going to be done. Their understanding was, we'll pay the purchase price, and as soon as the Evanses get their release from the FSA mortgage, then we get the property. So they were all surprised when they got this contract. They looked it over, and according to my client's unrebutted testimony, they said, well, we've already paid our purchase price, so we've done everything we can do under the contract, so it shouldn't be a problem. We'll go ahead and sign it. They still didn't know about the promissory note deed of trust. That was all done between the Evanses and the Clarks. So time went on. A lot of time went on. Actually, 5 years and 2 months went on. And finally, the Evanses were able to get a release of it. And initially, they said, okay, we're going to convey the property just like we agreed to, until they were told by a real estate agent, oh, this property is actually worth well over $2 million, not the $200,000 that you sold it for, at which time they changed their mind. Said, no, we're not going to give this property to you. So my clients, they're a little dismayed. They went to attorney Lynn French and said, hey, what can we do? Can we get this property? We paid for it. Now the release is done. We think it's a done deal. So he went to Willis Carpenter, a renowned expert in Colorado real estate law, and said, what do you think about this case? Here's the contract. And Willis Carpenter, Lynn French, looked at it and said, you know, the equities favor the Norries in this case and the Clarks. They've done everything that they can do under the contract. We think you have a good case for specific performance. So the case was filed. And here's the really remarkable part. After a trial, the district court in this case said, yes, I agree. They win. They get specific performance. The contract's ambiguous. It's messy. It's poorly written. It's a little hard to understand, but I know one thing for sure, and that is they did everything they could do under the contract when they paid the full purchase price. And they did so, you know, with good faith.
At the trial, excuse me for interrupting, but at the trial, was the expired, the expiration date discussed? Was that a position taken by the Evanses, that the contract had expired?
Yes, I believe they did take that position, that it had expired, and the...
So when the trial court ordered specific performance, I know he, I've read what he has said after the fact, but basically he was saying, it's not expired because I'm ordering specific performance, right?
Right, and I think that the trial court did that, while it wasn't entirely clear, I think that if you look at the whole record, the trial court did that because they held that the option was exercised with payment of the full purchase price. In fact, the trial court said, well, it doesn't really matter if it's a contract for sale or an option contract, when you pay the full purchase price, they've done everything they can do under it. And I think it's interesting that the opposition has not even responded to our Clark v. Senna case, which I think is very much on point in this case, and that's the one that said, well, when you have a real estate deal, and this happens a lot in the state of Colorado, where in that particular case, the buyer was ready, willing, and able to perform. He was just 3 days late from the day that closing was supposed to occur. And the court said, well, that's okay. He was technically out of contract, but he was ready, willing, and able to perform, and it didn't really harm the sellers. So they ordered specific performance. So I think that's a remarkable case that is directly on point. And another case that I want the court to look at, which they did not respond to, was the Cherokee case, which I cited on numerous occasions, the Cherokee Metropolitan District case. And that is important because that stands for the proposition where you have different judges, legal minds disagreeing upon the import of a contract. It is not frivolous. It's not correct to say that the losing party is frivolous in their position. In that case, it was the Colorado Supreme Court. Three of the justices dissented and said, we interpret this contract differently, just like the district court did in this case and said, I interpret this contract differently than what the Court of Appeals did. And they tried to get their attorney's fees saying it was frivolous. And the Supreme Court said, no, because reasonable legal minds can differ, it's not frivolous. Well, that's what happened in this case. And I think that the district court believed that it didn't have any choice because the Court of Appeals ruled that the contract had expired. So it just said, okay, Court of Appeals, you did that. So I've got to hold that this is frivolous. But that was incorrect of the district court to do that. The district court should have applied the statutory factors. It should have looked at the factor that it should have looked at the fact that it held in the first case that they win. It gets specific performance. It didn't look at the equitable claim that we made. It didn't look at the alternative argument of the contract interpretation that we put forth in our brief, and that is this contract is ambiguous. If you interpret that contract to say that the 5-year period only applies to payment, then they weren't out of contract. Now, I know...
Pardon me for interrupting, counsel, if I may, sure. Please. I'm wondering if you can help me with, after the second trial, the trial court's statement that, well, I didn't look at this issue of the contract's expiration the first time around. As Judge Miller asked you, that apparently was at least in a summary judgment motion, and the Evanses put forth that defense repeatedly. So what was the trial court saying there? Can you help me with that, please?
Well, I was a little confused when the trial court said that because in their original decision, and I can probably find it to you fairly quickly, they did mention the 5 years. And I think they could have done it better, but they did mention the 5 years, and they said it doesn't matter because they had fully performed. The Norris had fully performed by payment of that. So I think that it was implied in the first ruling that the court did take that 5-year provision into account and held, well, it applied to payment, not to closing. Once my clients did what they were obligated to do, all they had to do was wait for the release. So we're not arguing that the release wasn't a contingency or closing wasn't a contingency, but we're arguing that there was no time limit on that once payment was made.
But that horse is out the barn. I mean, the substance of that issue is out of the barn.
because the Court of Appeals reversed that determination. But I'm assuming that you're raising that for the purpose of saying, well, that argument wasn't frivolous, right?
Exactly, Your Honor. We're not trying to get the land now. That's a done deal. What we're trying to show is that the original lawsuit was not frivolous. We had some good bases. Mr. French, Mr. Carpenter, they had a reasonable basis for bringing this motion or bringing the lawsuit. My clients were relying on the advice of their counsel in good faith, so held by the district court. So we're not arguing. I realize that it's out of the barn, but this is a very important issue, this frivolous and groundless thing, and we're arguing that, no, we had an alternative basis for our lawsuit, a couple of them, actually.
You're at just about 5 minutes left.
All right. Well, then I'll defer to my...
That's up to you. I'm just reminding you.
All right. Thanks.
May it please the court, Earl Rhodes, registration number 6723 on behalf of Attorney Lynn French. I apologize for starting with a conclusion, but Mr. French asserts that the trial court committed reversible error by comparing his conduct to the facts set forth in the Court of Appeals decision of February 4th, 2010, and not viewing his conduct in the context of the trial court's own orders. And what has happened here is that the Court of Appeals reversed the trial court and made a determination that the date for closing was a clear date in the contract and that the trial court was incorrect in finding that the contract was ambiguous. The trial court then, in performing its analysis under 1317.101, did not go through the eight factors, as it should have, but rather jumped to the conclusion that the filing of the complaint was frivolous because the Court of Appeals had determined that the date for closing was clear. If Mr. French is correct in this argument, then the trial court decision cannot stand. The record is clear that the trial court, on three different occasions, addressed exactly the issue which Your Honor was talking about here, and which has gone through this whole case, which is whether the contract was clear on its face, whether the date of closing, the five-year limitation was clear, or whether the contract was ambiguous. But the court determined that the contract was ambiguous in a motion for summary judgment on October 29, 2008. It ruled in plaintiff's favor at trial in its order of January 15, 2009, and also ruled in plaintiff's favor in the post-trial motion on March 13, 2010. Mr. French asserts that when his client prevails at trial, that his conduct cannot be frivolous and groundless.
Is there case law to that effect?
Well, thank you for asking that. I have reviewed the case law, and let me go through it. There is no case law in the state of Colorado on these specific facts. I would tell you that the two cases cited by counsel for the Evans are not helpful in analysis of this case, the Anderson case and the Western United Realty case. Neither of those cases support Judge Greenacre's conclusion, and that the case law in Colorado is very strong in supporting the argument of Mr. French that the trial court was in error. I mean, factor G of the eight factors in section 103 says how did the party do in the proceedings? The party prevailed through trial here. Factor A says did counsel act in good faith? Mr. French is a very experienced real estate attorney. He consulted with a real estate expert, Willis Carpenter. The trial court found these things. The Western United Realty case stands for the proposition that if the plaintiff's claims survives a motion to dismiss, then it's not frivolous. The Munoz case we cited stands for the proposition that even if the plaintiff's claim is denied or is dismissed on a motion for summary judgment, it's not frivolous. The City of Holyoke case stands for the proposition that if counsel acts in good faith, his conduct cannot be found frivolous. What's going on here is that throughout this case, the plaintiff and counsel for the plaintiff and for the Norris presented a rational argument as to interpretation of this contract. And Colorado law is uniform that such a rational argument defeats a claim of frivolous and groundless. Mr. French, of course, takes this matter personally. But from a more objective point of view, parties have to have access to the courts so that issues can be resolved. It is just completely inappropriate to argue that the Norris and the Clarks could not get into court and ask a judge for relief under these circumstances. They've been on the property 20 years. They've paid the $200,000. And the court's ruling, in effect, stifles that. It's clear that the frivolous and groundless statute is not intended to curb the zealousness of attorneys. And the trial court decision should be reversed, because not only is it an illegal decision, but as a public policy matter, it imposes a chilling effect on the right of access of the public to the courts. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes.
Can I just ask just a pure procedural
sure.
question?
Yes.
Am I correct that Mr. French represented both the Norris and the Clarks up until the point he withdrew?
On behalf of the, and to the point he withdrew on behalf of the Norris.
Okay.
Yes. In the first round, he represented both of them.
Through the appeal?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Ms. Ebisch? And the time is set for 25 minutes for you, and when the yellow light comes on, that's 5 minutes left.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, there are numerous issues in this appeal and cross appeal, numerous issues. There are multiple parties. There are very complicated facts in this case. This case involves very long litigation, extensive briefing. What I would like to do in my time here in oral argument is, first of all, to focus on the Evans's cross appeal, particularly on two main issues in this cross appeal. First of all, that the Norris case that was filed 10 CV-142 should have been dismissed by the trial court, and that it was error for the trial court to not have dismissed that case when it was initially filed. And the second issue I would like to focus on is that the trial court erred in not finding that there was slander of title on the Evans's title to their property, or in dismissing, and that they also erred in dismissing the Evans's claim for damages, which they would have been entitled to under either a slander of title claim or under the statutory section 3835109. In addition to focusing on those two main issues, I will also respond to the Norris and French's arguments and address any other issues or questions which this court has. Starting from what took place from the point of the previous Court of Appeals decision in this case, which happened in February 2010, the Court of Appeals decision in that case turned on one thing. The Norris claim for specific performance was not an available remedy because the contract had expired. It reversed the trial court and it remanded the case with directions to reinstate the defendant's counterclaims and to conduct proceedings consistent with the opinion. The Evanses were allowed then to reinstate their counterclaims. They amended their counterclaims, and at that point, the Norris filed a new lawsuit, 10 CV-142. The Evanses filed a motion to dismiss or motion for summary judgment, and it was at this point that the first error occurred. That newly filed case should have been dismissed under any one of the three legal theories that the Evanses argued. First, that the Norris elected their remedies in their first case. They elected the remedy of specific performance. Second, that their claims were precluded because they decided not to bring a case for on the promissory note or for damages as an alternative in the first action, and or under renunciation, because the Nouries all throughout the first case for specific performance again and again renounced the fact that they had made any type of a loan.
But on appeal, isn't that how the Court of Appeals characterized the transaction? Didn't the Court of Appeals actually say that that the $200,000 placed by the Nouries with the Evans was a loan?
They did not exactly say that. What the Court of Appeals said in dicta was the Nouries are not without a remedy. They can attempt to recover the $200,000 loan pursuant to the promissory note. But this was dicta. The Court of Appeals did not say they could collect it under the promissory note, just that they could attempt to collect it. And the reason this is dicta is because that issue was not in front of the Court of Appeals the first time around. The previous panel did not hear the Evans' defenses. The issue of election of remedies was not made to this panel. It was clear why the Nouries wanted to have, why they chose, and they gambled on choosing only the remedy of specific performance. They wanted title to the property, and that's because that by the time this lawsuit came around in 2008, there was evidence that the property was worth $2 million, and they had paid $200,000. They gambled by not asserting in the alternative that they were entitled to damages if they weren't successful on this, on their specific performance claim.
Pardon me for interrupting, Ms. Ebisch. I want you to help me with your comment that the opinion that talks about the alternative remedy is dicta. Is this sentence from that first opinion dicta too? If the judgment were allowed to stand, defendants would have received nothing for the property because they would lose the property but remain liable on the $200,000 promissory note. The defendants were your clients. Is that dicta?
It contributes to the analysis that the court came up with. But yes, I think it's dicta.
So if the Nouries and the Clarks had come back and said, well, it's okay down in the trial a second time, it's okay if the Evanses receive nothing and they still owe us. They owe us on both the property and the money. Could they have made that claim?
No, Your Honor, because that they had already litigated that claim. The issue that the Court of Appeals decided in the first case was that there was a provision in the option contract that it expired.
I understand, but in the language that you're talking about as being dicta, we've got that sentence. And that sentence seems to me to be crucial to the holding, because that sentence makes it clear that the Evanses can't be put in a position where they both lose the land.
Correct.
And owe $200,000.
Right.
So I don't know if what you're talking about is really dicta or whether it's crucial to the holding.
It's our contention, Your Honor, that it's dicta.
Okay. Can I ask you a question? You paid, your clients paid, excuse me, $300,000+ as a judgment on the loan claim, correct?
It was, I think it was $356,000, yes.
Yeah.
They did that in order to avoid foreclosure.
No, I understand. I'm just trying to clarify. Is it your position that they're entitled to have all that money returned to them, or only interest and late charges that you think were not appropriate? In other words, are they entitled to a return of the principal?
Yes, Your Honor. That's our position.
So they get their cake and eat it too under your position, right?
Your Honor, that was a choice that the Nouries made when they initiated the first case asking for specific performance only.
But that case was not completed yet, was it?
What case?
I don't remember the numbers exactly. 08 CV something or another.
That case was completed, Your Honor.
Oh, I thought it was relitigated down on remand.
The only thing that was relitigated, what was relitigated was the Evanses were allowed to reassert their counterclaims against the Nurys for slander of title and for the filing of a groundless lien under two statutory provisions. They amended their counterclaims to add an abusive process and malicious prosecution counterclaim. The Nurys started a new case, 10 CV 142, this new promissory note case. Those two cases were consolidated, and the trial court used the 08 case, the number from the very first litigation. But our contention is that this second case was a completely new case. I agree it was consolidated, but it's a different case.
The 08 case was not finalized yet. It was not completed. It was still ongoing. I agree on different issues,
yes,
but that case was still continuing at the time.
That is true.
And does claim preclusion apply under those circumstances?
Yes.
Because it could come back up on appeal, and this division might disagree with the court's, the prior division, and say, no, you know, we think specific performance should have been under.
Your Honor, under the law of the case,
it doesn't bind the Court of Appeals. Does it, or are you suggesting it does?
Well, I looked at that issue, Your Honor. And the overarching rule is that if you can follow the decision from the previous court, that should be followed. If there's been a change in the law, then there may be a reason for a new decision. Of course, the ultimate goal is to have the right decision at the end of the long litigation between all of the parties. I agree with that.
Ms. Ibish, aren't the concepts of law of the case and claim preclusion different?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if we have a law of the case issue, that's one thing. But that doesn't mean that the case is final for the imposition of claim preclusion, does it?
It's our contention, again, that there were, that the Nurys' new claim under the promissory note was a separate action, and it was not, even though it was consolidated with this action, that their claims under 10 CV 142 should have been precluded. They elected their remedy. They could have elected that remedy in the first case, and they shouldn't be allowed to litigate that again.
I'm going to ask you one more question now, and then I'll let you go for a while.
Okay.
It goes back to my question about what's holding and what's not. I think the Court of Appeals was being pretty clear that they weren't going to give the Clarks and the Nurys, allow them to have their cake and eat it too. I think that's what that language was talking about. And yet you've just conceded to Judge Miller that that's what you want to do. You want to have your cake and eat it too. And if that language from the opinion is not dicta, if it is holding, I don't think it lets you do that. Am I wrong about that?
Well, again, it gets back to what Judge Miller was talking about, which is the Court of Appeals bound by the first, by what happens with the first decision? Our position, I agree with you that if it was the holding in the first case, that this court should be following that, and that it would be the law of the case. I think that the Court of Appeals in the first case, that their decision, which was stated at least three times in its opinion, that the contract was clearly contemplated that the agreement would expire if the FSA lien was not released by April 5th, 2006. It was clear that there was no intention that there was should be a sale of the property. And it also talked about clear and unambiguous terms that the release of the security, of the FSA security, was a condition that had failed.
Can I just interrupt?
Mm-hmm.
If it was so clear, it took your clients a year and a half before they said, oh, guess what? Now that the price is up a lot higher, we think it expired. We think the contract expired. Didn't everybody operate on the understanding that it had not expired for a year and a half after the April 5th of 2006?
No, Your Honor, the testimony did not contested on that point. The Evanses claimed in their testimony in the first trial that that they did not have a copy of the option contract in their possession, that they thought that it was had a 10-year, they knew it had an expiration provision in it. They thought it was a 10-year provision, but when
10-year or tenure?
10-year, okay. Y-E-A-R. Yes. And that when they got a copy of the contract and saw that it was 5 years, that they then realized that that it had expired. So the Evanses disagree with the statement of facts that were stated by Mr. Stimpert with regard to that provision. The Evanses testified that they never agreed to sell the property once they read the contract again and saw that the expiration was 5 years. There was just confusion about the amount of time.
But is it fair to say that at least for some time after the expiration of the contract on the 5th of April, at least for some time, the Evans thought, even though they may have made a mistake of fact, but they thought they were still bound by it.
They thought they were bound by it, and they wanted to sell their property. I mean, that's why they entered into the option contract, but they knew that it had an expiration date, and they knew that the property had increased in value, and when they saw the expiration date was 5 years, they did not want to be bound by it because they did not have to be bound by it.
But it's not that they discovered that 5-year term on the 7th of the 6th of April of 2006. It took a while, right?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't think there was any discussion about the sale of the property. I'm trying to remember the testimony now between April 2006 and 2007 until I think Glenn Clark was talking to the Evanses about it. He was living on the property. It wasn't a situation where there was a lot of impetus by any party to actually do the changing of title of that property. But the Evanses wanted to finally sell it. It was a very valuable piece of property. They remembered there was an expiration. They didn't have a copy of the agreement. And when they found out it was 5 years, they remembered, okay, that was 5 years. That's what we put in there, and that's what everyone's bound by. And then we had the resulting litigation where the trial court completely ignored the fact that there was this 5-year term or a limit of time within which the FSA lien had to be released and that the option contract had expired. I want to move on to my next argument, which is that the trial court erred in not allowing the Evanses or not ignoring the Evanses' damages for their for the loss of value in their property, which was a great damage to them, because the Nouris filed the option contract, or they recorded it in 2007 on the property, and in January of 2008, they recorded the list pendants on the property, which then encumbered the property from January of 2008 until there was the overlapping list pendants recorded when the second case was filed, 10 CV 142. So the Evanses' property was encumbered by a list pendants all the way up until 2014, so more than 6 years. The evidence showed at trial that the Evanses' property was worth approximately $1.2 million in 2007 when the Nouris first claimed that they were entitled to have title to the property, and they claimed that this was a purchase contract instead of an option contract. Through 2011, when the second trial, the evidence showed that the Nouris property or the Evanses' property was worth between $500,000 and $700,000. The trial court improperly held that the Evanses did not show that they suffered special damages. The trial court likened the statute 3835-1093 to a slander of title claim, and under the Skyland Metropolitan District case, it said, special damages involve some effect on the owner's ability to sell the property. At a minimum, the property must be on the market for sale, and a tort must create a cloud on the title. And the issue that the trial court turned on, which was an error, was that it found that the Evans' property was not on the market for sale simply because it was not listed for sale with a multi-listing service. But there was a lot of evidence that showed that the Evans's showed more than a general intention to sell their property.
I understand the point you're making, but isn't the more fundamental question whether there was malice to support the slander of title claim?
That is an element for under slander of title, but it is not an element under the statute 3835-2042, which allows for damages and attorneys. I'm sorry, 3835-1093, where it says that the person who files a spurious document is liable for $1,000 or for actual damages plus attorney's fees.
And so you have to prove that it's a spurious document, right?
Yes, and the trial court did find that it was a spurious document, and we agree with that, but we just do not agree that it that there were no damages. There was the list pendants was in place. The Evanses had entered into an option contract that showed that they wanted to sell the property. They had contacted adjacent landowners. They'd done a market analysis in August of 2007. They had their property listed for sale in 2011 for $1.99 million and declined an offer. Someone had made an offer on the property. So we would request that the trial court or that the Court of Appeals reverse the trial court on this issue.
How much was that offer for?
The offer was for
$500,000. $500,000. It wasn't right. For $1.2 or $1.9 million.
No. And there was a, and this was in 2011. So that shows the decline in value, which the Evanses had their, you know, their property, their very valuable property, tied up for many, many years because of the Nouri's claim that this was a purchase contract, which it was not because it had expired, and that the Evanses should have been compensated for that. So I'm going to sit down now, and I'll reserve the rest of my arguments for my remaining 5 minutes.
Thank you, Ms. Ebisch. Mr. Stempert, you have 10 minutes left.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to address a few facts here first, because they keep saying some things which just aren't in the record and which are inconsistent with the record, and it's really important to get the facts right. First of all, I wanted to further respond to your question about what the trial court said in addressing the 5 years. I found that in their findings of fact, conclusion of law and judgment, the first one on page 15 of that decision, page 195 of the record order, the court said, thus, by paying the purchase price in full, plaintiffs indicated their intention to exercise the option. Moreover, that exercise was accomplished before the five-year termination date stated in the agreement. So the trial court clearly did believe that the option contract, the five-year period, only applied to payment, not to payment and release and closing. So there's that. Another fact. They keep arguing, you're right, the malice is an element. And the trial court specifically held that there was no malice. They keep trying to demonize my clients and say that they intentionally did something wrong, but the finder of fact, the trial court said over and over and over that that wasn't the case. On their findings of fact on remand, on page 7 of that decision, said the court finds that plaintiffs acted with the advice of counsel and in good faith. Albeit mistaken, believe that they had a valid claim for specific performance on the agreement.
But the court did find it was a spurious document, right?
The court did find that, but again, that's why we're here arguing this, mm-hmm. that it wasn't spurious because we had an alternative argument.
So I think the district court was confused in its second ruling, but this is a fact. It was wrong about its conclusion about the legal import of the contract on remand. It was not wrong about the facts. And I would agree with the district court's first analysis of the contract. But again, that's neither here nor there. And now we're only here arguing that it wasn't frivolous and groundless. If it wasn't frivolous and groundless, it's not spurious. The case law shows the tomato, tomato. Again, on page 10 of that decision, it says, as noted in the findings of fact, plaintiffs did not act with malice in regard to the finding of a filing of a notice of Liz Pendens. A third fact, on this renunciation thing, the court made very clear findings of fact. Again, on page 18 of the second findings of fact, in the middle of the paragraph, the court said, as a matter of fact, the Norris paid the money with the belief that they would be able to purchase the property, and Mr. Evans executed the promissory note deed of trust to secure repayment of the amount paid by the Norris and Evans in the event that the Evanses could not secure a release of the FSA loan. Finding of fact. The testimony in the prior case showed that the Norris expected to be repaid in the event that the sale did not occur. Having failed on their specific performance plan, the Norris are now seeking to enforce the promissory note. This court's exactly right. They're asking to have their cake and eat it too. It's remarkable. They're saying, well, now that we don't have to give you the land, we get to keep your money too. Talk about biting the hand that feeds you. This $200,000 paid off medical bills and got their entire ranch out of hock. And now they're selling it for a lot more money, and they have sold it for a lot more money. And they're saying, we get to keep the Norris money on top of that.
You're actually trying to get it twice, aren't you? You're trying to get it from, and I think you succeeded in getting it both on the note and then also an unjust enrichment claim against Mrs. Evans, right?
We have two judgments, but not two satisfactions. We've acknowledged that we can't double dip on the $200,000. The only difference we have now is the calculation of interest between the unjust enrichment claim, which is at 8% compounded, versus the note, which is 6%. So that's another issue, but we're not trying to say that we get $200,000 twice or interest twice. We've never asserted that. It's never been asserted in this case. Last factual thing I wanted to point out on the damages. This is a very interesting thing in that the Evanses put on the stand an expert witness, an appraiser, and he appraised the value of the property currently as of the date of the trial. What he did not do was appraise it in 2001 or at the time that the lawsuit was filed. They didn't rely on that. Instead, they relied on Liz Sawatsky, the very person that got all the worked up over this $2 million property thing in the first place, and their own opinion. And while people that aren't experts can potentially, you know, talk about their value of their own land, the case law, which we've cited, is very clear that if they're going to do that, they have to have some credibility. They have to be at least somewhat similar to what an appraiser would do. They have to do comparable sales. They didn't do that in this case. They didn't compare apples to apples. It was apples to elephants. So the reason why we didn't put an expert on is they didn't put an expert on, and their testimony about damages simply wasn't credible. In fact, there was a big hoopla about the Cockers, Joe Cocker. They said, oh, well, Joe Cocker was going to buy our property for $2.5 million. Well, I put Mrs. Cocker and their assistant on the stand, and they said, that never happened. We didn't even talk to the Evanses about that, nor do we want to buy their property. That's false. That's a myth. So there was a lot of hoopla around this damage thing, but they just did not put any evidence on that this notice of Liz Pendens caused them any actual damages. And the case law is clear that they have to have actual special damages to collect on this.
So you're saying the person who offered the appraisal was not qualified as an expert?
No, he was qualified as an expert, but he did not offer an opinion as to the value of the land in 2001
okay.
or 2007. In order to show a decline, you've got to have a baseline. You've got to say, okay, well, it's worth this much. Now it's worth this much. Mm-hmm. And he didn't do that. He only showed what it was worth as of the time of the trial, after the notice of Liz Pendens had been released. So there's just no evidence in the record.
When was the notice released?
Pardon me?
When was the notice released?
Shortly after remand from the Court of Appeals in
2010.
Yeah, in that spring. What happened is they sent us a letter saying, and this is when I first came on in the case, they said, you know, please release. We said, okay, we'll release, no problem at that point, because we had the Court of Appeals. So, and then we said, give us your money back, and they said, no, we want to keep your money. So here we are now. I also wanted to mention that I want to address briefly the issue of jurisdiction of their claim, that they're saying that we don't have to pay the $200,000 back with interest. The district court was found in their findings of fact that they intentionally tried to mislead us about this issue. And the case law is clear. If you voluntarily pay off the full amount, you know, the full amount of the loan, or the full amount of the amount that's due with interest and with attorney's fees, you foreclose the right to appeal it. And they are arguing over and over, their only defense to this is, well, it wasn't voluntary. We had to do it, otherwise it was going to be foreclosed. They didn't ask for a stay. They intentionally tried to mislead us, according to the district court. They said, okay, well, give us the release now. And then the very day, that same day, they started filing motions to alter and amend and file an appeal on this. So it's very disingenuous and completely opposite of what the district court found factually to argue that it wasn't voluntary. The fact is they paid everything under the promissory note and deed of trust voluntarily, and then immediately that same day continued to litigate it, saying, oh, we're done, you now have to release. So I don't believe that they have jurisdiction for the appeal at all, and that's an issue this court has to look at. So I have a minute 20 left. Are there any questions?
I guess not.
No questions? All right. Well, could I reserve a minute just for Sir Rebuttal then?
No.
After she goes?
No.
All right.
We're not going
to. Well, I'll stand on it. Good
okay.
Try.
You can use your minute and 10 seconds if you want to, but.
Now.
Now, yeah.
It's okay, Your
Honor. Okay.
I'd like to respond to the last argument first, which is the jurisdictional argument. Yes, it is true that Dave Evans paid off the amount that was found by the trial court due on the promissory note in order to avoid the judicial foreclosure. The question on mootness is there a judgment to be reviewed? And the answer is yes. There's many aspects of this judgment to be reviewed. And in fact, the Norries actually they argued on appeal at issues related to the amount of interest that was that's due on this judgment. So under the Frankfather case, which is the leading case on this issue, unless the payment is by way of compromise and settlement, or there's an agreement not to appeal, if the judgment debtor satisfies the judgment, then he does not waive his right to appeal. And I think that's pretty well briefed, and we completely disagree that there is not jurisdiction to decide this matter or that it's moot. There's many issues relating to that, and it's not moot. I'd also like to touch on the issue of the judgment both for unjust enrichment and on the promissory note that was in error by the trial court. The trial court had a legal remedy for recovery, assuming you don't agree with my claim preclusion and election of remedies case. There was a legal remedy on the promissory note for return of that money, and it was improper for the trial court to have also entered an order for unjust enrichment, and especially trying to get additional interest since the 8% statutory interest rate is higher than the 6% rate on the promissory note. With regard to the evidence of damages, I disagree with Mr. Stimpert's characterization of the testimony. There was absolutely no testimony by the Norries during the second trial in contravention of the Evans's testimony. The Evans's both testified as owners as to what the value of the property was in 2007 when the beginning of 2008 when the list pendants was first recorded on the property, and the decline in value, and they testified as to what the value was as of the time of the second trial. And there was a very experienced and longtime real estate agent from the Valley who testified, and she gave a report, which is part of the record, and testified in support of that report regarding the value of the property.
However, isn't the trial court free to believe any or none of that testimony?
The trial court never got to that issue because it claimed that the Evanses were not trying to sell the property, that it was not for sale. And that's where I think the trial court was wrong. Finally, I would like to address the issue regarding the frivolous and groundless statute, and that under 1317-102, the court properly sanctioned both Mr. French and the Nouries in this case because their actions lack substantial justification. The filing of the specific performance claim had no basis. The option contract was very clear, and the Court of Appeals in the first decision used the words clear and unambiguous over and over again. The trial court focused in the second case in deciding the frivolous and groundlessness on what the trial court had overlooked in the first case. And the trial court said that the contract expired if the FSA lien had not been released in 5 years, and said that the plaintiffs did not offer any interpretation that was inconsistent with the Court of Appeals. So nothing was, in the trial court's view, nothing had been offered by the Nouries that was inconsistent with the fact that there was this very plain provision saying that the option contract had expired. And additionally, there was no facts that would support either a waiver of that expiration date or an extension of that date that was offered by the Nouries. And therefore, it was appropriate for the trial court to have ordered those fees. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Avish. The court thanks all counsel for your arguments and your briefs, and they will be very helpful to the court in reaching an opinion on this case. The case will now stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.